sort of a footnote. When I mentioned the Volunteers Motivations Database, this is a database that I compiled as part of my PhD research based on an analysis of the metadata drawn from 100 interviews with veterans of the Second World War, Irish veterans of the Second World War. This database is going to be, I'm in the process of expanding this database to include 500 interviewees as part of a monograph that I'm developing from my PhD thesis. Just to make you aware of that. It could be argued that from the very outset of the Second World War until the conclusion of the conflict, the constant arrival of Irish migrants at ports and cities around the United Kingdom was perhaps one of the more visible features of a benevolent relationship between neutral era and wartime Britain. Robert Fisk and Claire Wills describe this moment quite eloquently in their narratives, occasionally with a hint of irony, but the significance of voluntary manpower coming from Southern Ireland to aid Britain's war effort is directly implied. In the opinion of Tracy Connolly, the Second World War would prove to be a watershed in 20th century Irish emigration, with a net immigration figure of 189,942 for the period of 1936 to 1946, according to census data, representing an annual average net increase of 13.9% from the 1926 to 36 census. Britain was identified as the primary destination for these migrants. The figures of the Department of External Affairs additionally indicate that more than 172,000 exit permits were issued from 1941 until 1945. E.N.S. Wood similarly quotes a figure suggested by several accounts of 180,000 Irish citizens that moved to Britain seeking employment during the war years. The renowned Irish Army historian J.P. Duggan would also acknowledge that in the struggle to defeat the evils of Nazism, neutral era had nothing to be ashamed of, and he pays warm tribute to the thousands of Irishmen who died at the tip of the spear. That's where they generally were, on the battlefields, and they had 8 Victoria Crosses to prove it. He also points to the many thousands who worked in the munitions factories, farms and hospitals, and praises their war effort as an extraordinary unsung contribution. One group that were especially noted for being at the tip of the spear were the Anglo-Irish Protestant volunteers who joined the British forces. Their presence and significance in the armed forces was particularly evidenced by the senior positions held by Irish Protestant officers. Dublin-born brothers General Alan Cunningham and Admiral Andrew Cunningham, for instance, had both risen to senior positions within their respective services by the outbreak of war. General Cunningham briefly commanded the 8th Army in North Africa before being relieved by another general of Irish descent, Claude Auchinleck, himself later replaced by Bernard Law Montgomery, also of Irish Protestant descent, while his brother Admiral Cunningham commanded the Mediterranean Fleet, won stunning victories against the Italian Navy at Taranto and Cape Matapan, and later became Admiral of the Fleet and was appointed First Sea Lord in 1943. According to Stephen O'Connor, the family tradition of military service would resonate most strongly among the old Irish ascendancy classes, who, until the First World War, had provided the overwhelming majority of Irish officers for Britain's armed forces. The Second World War would not be an exception to this rule, and members of the Irish Protestant community, to a man and to a woman in some instances, opted to serve in the British forces during this conflict. Their expressed reasons for doing so indicate an affiliation to Britain and the cause for which she was fighting in the war, but also a strong sense of family military tradition, combined with a sentiment of strong pro-British loyalty evident within their families. Throughout the course of the Second World War, the position of Southern Irish Protestant volunteers was decidedly pro-British, reflecting similar feelings of loyalty to the mother country, which had been demonstrated by Irish Protestants prior to independence throughout the First World War. Nevertheless, this ideological stance expressed by members of the remnant Irish Unionist faction living in the Irish state was tempered by a general respect for the policy of neutrality that had been initiated by Eamon de Valera's government in 1939. In addition, some notable champions of the Irish Unionist interest, mainly retired British Army officers, led by the chief architect of the current incident, General Sir Hubert Delapuere Gough, had registered strong objections against the antagonism of the Stormont government of Lord Craigavon and John Miller Andrews towards neutral era. They would also advert to the fact that tens of thousands of Southern Irish Protestant volunteers had joined the British forces, compared with the paltry numbers that had stepped forward from Northern Ireland to fight for king and country. They weren't actually paltry, they just said they were. This paper shall explore the attitudes of Irish Protestant community in neutral Ireland during the war, and will delve deeply into the motivations of Southern Protestant volunteers who served in the British forces. In so doing, it will unveil the impact that the First World War and the Irish Revolution of 1916-23 had upon some of the families of young Irish Protestants who chose to join up. Lastly, this chapter will discuss, with the aid of oral history testimonies, or rather the analysis of the metadata of the collection of oral history testimonies, the wartime experiences of a sample of Irish Protestant volunteers, and will evaluate their opinions on Irish neutrality, as well as their perceptions regarding their place within the pre-war Irish state. During the war, there was, predictably, considerable curiosity in London about ERA's position, especially relating to the division of opinion in Ireland between those who recognised the moral ascendancy of Britain in the war and questioned whether Southern Ireland was justified in remaining neutral. The most reliable method for the British to determine these attitudes and to survey the opinions of Irish citizens at home or abroad in Britain was to read their mail. Churchill's War Cabinet was very fortunate to have access to postal censorship reports based on examinations of intercepted mails sent between the two countries, mainly from Irish correspondents in Britain writing to their families back home. This convenient facility would enable the British government to closely monitor attitudes in ERA while discerning the feelings of Irish citizens living in Britain or serving in the British forces. What would be heavily emphasised in the postal censorship report sent to the War Cabinet at the start of October 1941 was that many young Irishmen and women were serving in the Allied forces, and that this was not sufficiently recognised in England. In particular, there were two large excerpts taken from the letters of two individuals writing from Dublin, who proclaimed themselves to be either loyalists or loyal British subjects, and bitterly complained about the way in which they were being perceived in Britain because of the fact that their country was neutral. The first, addressed to a recipient in Suffolk, was checked in August 1941. It's hard that we, the loyal British subjects in ERA, must suffer with the government for not going to war. Every single relation of mine and yours is serving, and our only thought is for the British Empire, and that most of our friends who think we are such rats in England. Of course, the average Irish person has always hated England, and their argument is why be friendly now. It's a short-sighted policy, we know, and neutrality has its drawbacks. We never see the newsreel, for instance. Then they go on to say, we in the south of Ireland are disgusted with the people in the north of Ireland. The percentage of volunteering for military service in England is much higher than in the north. All of our young friends, girls and men have gone, but no one knows that and we get slated here, while the north gets all the benefits of being in the empire and have been awfully slack about doing their bit. The second letter examined in the postal censorship report, intercepted the day before the first, speaks of the humiliation endured by the small loyalist minority living in ERA at the hands of their own kinsfolk in Britain. We tiny minority of loyalists must accept our government's ruling. What else in God's name can we do except suffer in our hearts, send our sympathies, eatables, pray for you in our Protestant churches, only 3%, and writhe at the insults, sneers, digs and reproaches hurled at us over the air in your papers and by our British friends, and pray that when this war is over, the truth of the number of Southern Irish boys in your forces may be published in blazing figures. Reports such as these afford the observer a fascinating insight into the thoughts and feelings of Irish people at home and abroad, and the ability to take the pulse of an entire nation. It clearly influenced Churchill's decision, taken 2 months later, to form the 38th Irish Brigade, in spite of the opposition that he would face from the government of Northern Ireland to this proposal. However, Churchill's war cabinet were obviously keen to find evidence of negative attitudes towards De Valera's government from Irish personnel serving in Britain's armed forces, especially regarding the policy of neutrality. And they were also looking to determine how these Irishmen felt about serving the British war effort. In August 1941, General Sir Hubert Gough, together with two Anglo-Irish ex-army officers, Captain Henry Harrison and Maurice Healy, sent a letter to the Canadian wartime premier, William Mackenzie King, in which they denounced the raising of a local defence volunteer force analogous to the British Home Guard, claiming that the Ulster Home Guard had, in a very similar fashion to the UVF, which was recruited along political sectarian lines and is maintained free from British military discipline, been recruited in a manner which was adverse to the maintenance of peace and stability in Northern Ireland. This was further to a wider campaign in which Gough and a number of Anglo-Irish ex-British Army officers and Navy officers with pro-Irish sympathies, including Churchill's cousin Sir Shane Leslie and the famous aviator Colonel James Fitzmaurice, tried to oppose Craigavon's Ulster Defence Volunteers, as well as other potentially damaging policies of the Northern Government. And in September 1940, he sent a letter of protest signed by all involved to the British Prime Minister. This provoked a considerable outburst from the elderly Lord Craigavon when the issue was raised by local MPs in the Ulster House of Commons. Craigavon lumbered to his feet, got hold of the dispatch box and said, "Mr. Speaker, sir, General Gough has gone off." When Craigavon's successor, John Miller Andrews, attempted to have conscription extended to Northern Ireland in May 1941, Gough, Harrison and Healy all lent their voices to the torrent of public opposition by suggesting that the Commonwealth war effort could only be damaged by the imposition of conscription, since it would lead to domestic conflict and bloodshed, the ramifications of which would be felt globally, wherever there are Irish people or Catholics or lovers of freedom. In August 1941, Gough adverted to the existence of a powerful section of opinion in Britain and Northern Ireland, which had long looked forward to the recurrence of a world war as furnishing an opportunity for the reconquest of a self-governing Ireland by Ulster Protestant levies operating from Northern Ireland and with the full support of the British Army. This startling and sudden attack on the Ulster Unionist establishment, to say nothing of the entire Loyalist volunteer organisation in Northern Ireland, was predicated upon the belief that neutral era might be coaxed into the war on Britain's side through conciliatory methods. Gough believed that there was sufficient evidence of Irish goodwill to demonstrate that Southern Ireland would be a worthy ally of Britain. Recruits for His Majesty's the British Armed Forces have been coming freely and spontaneously from Ireland since the war began. We have reason to believe that Ireland, a population of less than 3 million, has sent some 120,000 voluntary recruits, whilst Northern Ireland, with a population of 1,250,000, has sent only 1,900. Ireland's neutrality forbids the existence of British recruiting agencies in Ireland, such as freely exist in Northern Ireland, side by side with British military and other units, a circumstance which makes these approximate figures all the more remarkable. Ireland's 120,000 are prominently nationalist Catholics of identical type with the nationalist Catholic minority in Northern Ireland, whose unhappy plight and enforced separation from the parent Ireland form the principal factor that determined Ireland's neutrality. This outstanding fact, pregnant with invaluable implications as to the essential and sincere goodwill of strictly neutral Ireland towards Britain and the Commonwealth, is either intentionally withheld from the British and world public, or else is overlooked and left unmentioned by news services and propaganda agencies. Nor is it mentioned in speeches of ministers, nor in the reports of parliamentary debates. We cannot forbear that comment that, in our opinion, the total eclipse of this very striking fact is as amazing and as significant as it has been infelicitous. Outraged by Gough's spectacular condemnation of the state of unionism and wartime politics in the six counties, Andrews felt it necessary to defend the honour of his province to his counterpart in Ottawa. He consulted his colleagues in cabinet, especially his close confidant, Richard Dawson Bates and Sir Basil Brooke, asking whether he should publish his response to Gough's claims. Brooke advised against doing so, unless Gough's letter has received publicity itself, feeling that Gough's tract demonstrated his ignorance of Irish affairs. However, it was upon the point of the sectarian-based composition of the Ulster Home Guard that Gough and his colleagues had made the strongest impression. In the wake of the controversy surrounding the Gough letter, Churchill would take soundings from the Home Office, War Office and Dominions Office. He wanted to let the matter drop, but reports the Catholics were being harassed at roadblocks by LDV personnel, and rumours the Catholics trying to join the Ulster Home Guard were being turned away proved most unhelpful. This matter had already been raised by the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Westminster, Dr. Bernard Griffin, who wrote to Downing Street to support Gough's arguments. Archbishop Griffin later delivered a controversial homily in November 1944, in which he compared the persecution of Catholics in Germany and Poland by the Nazis to the anti-Catholic sectarianism in Northern Ireland. In September 1941, Gough published an editorial in the Times in which he highlighted that a very large number of Irishmen have joined His Majesty's forces since the outbreak of war, arguing that this is their own spontaneous and unsolicited act, since owing to Irish neutrality, there have been no agencies where they could enlist at home and no recruiting campaign. He quoted the experiences of British military officers who had commanded Irish troops in the field and had little doubt regarding their excellent military qualities. Gough suggested that existing Irish units should be regrouped into an Irish brigade or division, he foresaw no insuperable military difficulties or objections from the military authorities to this proposal. This letter is typical of those which Gough published in the Times on the subject of the Irish Volunteers, and he openly campaigned for their welfare and for greater recognition of their contribution to the British war effort, in a manner which appears to contradict the notion that he was a lifelong unionist. During the first years of the war, for instance, he had been concerned that there was no facility or centre where Irish men and women could meet and rest in London. So he formed a committee, and with the help of an initial donation of £1,000 from the Guinness family, the Shamrock Club opened in Park Lane in March 1943. Gough's editorial also inspired an enthusiastic response from Churchill, who would write a short memo to the War Office requesting their opinion, and he pointedly observed, "We have Free French and Vichy French, so why not Loyal Irish and Dublin Irish?" At a meeting of the War Cabinet on October 9, 1941, he told his colleagues that there had been a number of indications that public opinion in Ireland would be gratified if some action was taken which acknowledged the considerable help we are receiving by the enlistment in our forces of volunteers from Southern Ireland. And he requested that his Secretary of State for War, David Margeson, should consider forming an Irish brigade in the British Army. Stung by the suggestion, John Andrews would complain about the proposal in a personal letter to Churchill. He repeatedly cited the feelings of pride and ownership which his people felt towards these Irish regiments, and the undesirability of both General Gough and Maurice Healy as the architects of this scheme, as well as the use of the title Irish Brigade, which he felt was synonymous with that of the formation that fought against England in the days of Marlborough. He listed out all the nefarious examples of Irish brigades in Sarsfield, including Major MacBride's brigade that fought alongside the Boers against the British, Roger Casement's effort to form a brigade from Irish POWs in Germany to fight against Britain in the First World War, and, of course, the more recent example of O'Duffy's Blueshirts in the Spanish Civil War. In spite of the significant opposition mounted by Stormont, the 38th Irish Brigade officially came into existence in January 1942. A distinguished Anglo-Irish soldier, Brigadier The O'Donovan, an Irish Protestant, and also an Irish Fusilier who had distinguished himself in France during the Great War, winning the Military Cross and losing an eye, had been chosen to command the brigade at the moment of its formation. The West Cork native was clearly humbled by the appointment, and he confided to his friend and fellow Fall, Kendall Chavas, that when the formation of the brigade was given to him, he felt that the mantle of Sarsfield had fallen upon his shoulders. And I must remark that this is a very interesting thing to say, given his Anglo-Irish Protestant heritage. The brigade he oversaw from formation, training, and eventual deployment acquired a distinctly Irish identity. An official brigade songbook would be commissioned with nationalist marching ballads such as Kevin Barry, The Soldier's Song, The Boys Who Beat the Black and Tans, along with loyalist songs like The Sash My Father Wore, The Ulster Volunteers, and The Auld Orange Flute. The Irish Unionist lobby in London had proven itself to be very effective at influencing British government policy to the advantage of neutral Ireland, and they were probably helped in this regard by Churchill's unnatural career-long obsession with both the Irish question and the status of an independent and neutral Irish state. However, it was clear that the position of powerful Southern Irish loyalists had shifted away from solidarity with the so-called brethren in the north and had instead settled on the question of how best to lure neutral Ireland back into the British fold. They were probably also cognizant of the fact that many members of their minority community in Southern Ireland were serving in the British forces in theatres across the globe. There are untold thousands of families throughout the entire island of Ireland whose relations served in both world wars, often forming part of a military tradition that in some cases stretches back for centuries. This is what Stephen O'Connor has identified as the family military tradition, the hereditary soldier. And he argues that this was especially strong in Ireland, particularly among the sons of landowners, for whom becoming an officer would originate in a family strategy designed to maintain their social and economic position within the landed gentry. A family tradition of military service in Ireland was by no means confined to the landed classes, however, and it extended to all classes of Irish society, regardless of whether the individuals concerned had come from an upper or lower sphere of society, were of wealthier or poorer means, or had originated from a Protestant or Catholic religious background. Bernard Kelly also indicates that the desire to continue a British family tradition in British military service was a powerful motivation to enlist, and he outlines that the practice of following the family path to the recruiting office was an established process, technically known as endo-recruitment. He has also observed that the greatest influence on the volunteers who joined the British forces from 1939 onwards was that the generation that had just preceded them had joined up to fight in the First World War in such large numbers, with over 200,000 Irishmen fighting in the conflict, of whom around under half, nearly 100,000 veterans, returned to Ireland in 1918. At the same time, in spite of negative and unfriendly attitudes that were shared by many at home, most of those who would make the personal decision to enlist in the British forces had little difficulty in reconciling their Irish identity with fighting in the British Armed Forces or contributing on the equally vital home front against Nazism. Albert Sutton, who joined the RAF, came from a working-class Church of Ireland family background in Dublin. He was strongly unionist and also had a tradition of service in the military, as well as in the police. His father served in the Dublin Metropolitan Police and had been involved in the arrests of rebels during the Easter Rising and took part in counterinsurgency activities in the city during the War of Independence. And this would become the profession that many male family members would subsequently enter. Albert had two uncles in An Garda Síochána, one of whom had served in France in the Royal Dublin Fusiliers during the Great War, and he had suffered so terribly from the after effects of a gas attack that Albert found it surprising that the Gardaí accepted him. But this uncle became a Garda sergeant, while the other uncle rose to the rank of Chief Garda Superintendent. Albert acknowledged the influence of his family's past military service, but did not attribute it to being his primary motive for joining the British forces. Their strongly unionist identity appeared to be a far more prevalent motivator than any other factor. David Robertson notes that Wilson Hospital's school pupils who volunteered for the British forces appeared to favour the RAF over the Army and the Royal Navy, since out of the total enrolment, 66% of past pupils enrolled in the RAF. Robertson's interpretation of this was simply that the thought of the repetition of the horrors of the trenches must have directed many towards the Royal Air Force. The highest number of interviewees whose motives were analysed in the Volunteers' Motivations Database, around 40%, joined the RAF, and 14% cited family military tradition as a reason for joining the service. The family military tradition involving service in the British Army was, nevertheless, a central component in the backgrounds of many RAF recruits, including Sidney James Gray, a Church of Ireland member from Bray, who had enlisted in the RAF in 1943, and he became one of thousands of Irish airmen who served in Bomber Command, operating as an air gunner in a Lancaster bomber crew alongside a fellow Dublin man, Jimmy Gilday. I think it was because all my mum's family had been in the Gloucester Regiment, and my great-granddad, he was a sergeant major, and they travelled the world like Malta with the Gloucesters, and we were living then in Ireland. We were always very British, you know, pro-British, loved the British, and we thought it was a terrible thing, and although they remained neutral through the war, they did certainly supply thousands of people to the forces. I know there was a hell of a lot in the RAF, and there was a hell of a lot in the army, weren't there? In Ireland, you got like many Roman Catholics and Protestants, and the majority of the Protestants were always very pro-British. Now, this interview was done in England, so he's speaking to a British interviewer. So he's speaking in terms that are more explanatory, where they seem to be familiar to us. Sidney Gray's testimony highlights another crucial factor in this respect, which is analysed in detail within the Volunteers Motivations database. 17% of the interviewees reported having a defined affiliation or sense of loyalty to Britain and the cause for which he was fighting in the war against Nazi Germany, which cannot be delineated upon religious or ethnic lines, as only 8 of those who responded in the affirmative were from an English, Church of Ireland or Anglican background, with the remainder being Roman Catholic, mixed faith or non-believers. Jeremy Jenkins, curator at the British Library, based on his own database research on the University College Cork Volunteers Project, places this figure at 9%, although this data does not provide an explanation for why the RAF proved to be the most popular service among the participants in the project. Albert Sutton also clarified that his family had strong pro-British sympathies, but he declined to place this at the heart of his reasoning for joining up. His lifelong friend Kenneth, who was also from a family where such sympathies were present, was a Dublin working-class Protestant who joined the Royal Artillery and served in the Burma campaign, but he had numerous military connections in his family, which stretched from before the two world wars all the way to the Vietnam War. In some cases, the ritual of family tradition proved extremely prevalent in the decision-making processes of some volunteers, particularly those from Church of Ireland backgrounds, and some even felt it was their duty to serve in honour of the service rendered by previous generations of their family. Corkman John Bennett German joined the British Army, enlisting in the Royal Artillery, where he rose to the rank of captain, but he was dissatisfied with his initial choice and traded in this rank to become a lieutenant, serving in No. 2 Army Commando, and saw action in Sicily, Yugoslavia, Albania and Italy. German stated that his mother's only brother was killed in World War I. He was in the Royal Munsters and was 19, and in some token way I felt I should take his place. There was some influence within his school to enlist, and even a tradition of service in the British forces, as he claimed that many fellow pupils, including several of his school friends, would also join up. And though he doesn't believe that it had any influence upon him, he stated that Church of Ireland people were more likely to be pro-British than Catholics. In certain cases, the family tradition of military service was so entrenched and well-established that it seemed inevitable that members of that generation would obtain commissions in the army. Billy Vincent served in 2nd Battalion of the Royal Inniskilling Fusiliers and would fight with the 38th Irish Brigade in Italy, and he recalled that although his father did not serve as a soldier in the First World War, he would join the American Field Ambulance Services with the French Army, while all his brothers went into the British Army because that was what they had done for many years before. Alec Crichton also described himself as coming from an ordinary Anglo-Irish background. His father had been a doctor who served as a medical officer in the First World War, and there was a solid tradition of military service in his family. However, when it came to the reasons why he himself joined the Irish Guards in the Second World War, Alec stated that among the people that his family mixed with, it was simply the done thing to join up. William Harvey Kelly had also come from a Church of Ireland military family, with his father and grandfather having served as British Army officers, along with many members of the respective generation of the family. He was also a pupil at Wilson's Hospital, where there was a long tradition of past pupils entering the British Army, or one of the branches of the armed forces, and William would acknowledge that he, along with some of his contemporaries, joined up in a similar manner. The Volunteers Motivations database shows that 35% of those who joined up did so because their peers were doing so, which adds weight to the theory that collective pressures that David Fitzpatrick argues were very much a feature during the First World War were also a feature of the Second World War. It also shows, however, that a family military tradition was a predominant motive, especially among those who joined the British Army. Irish Protestant women also served in the armed forces in considerable numbers. One of the many Irish members of the WAF was Maureen Deaton, who hailed from a Church of Ireland background in County Limerick. She experienced the bombing of two British cities during the war, London and Plymouth, and having already lived in England before the war, she felt that joining up was simply the right thing to do. It was the done thing, the right thing to do. You were fighting evil. I was fancy free, I was young, I had a bit of an education. Mostly it was because everyone else was. If I'd stayed in England, I'd have been called up. Deaton, who served as a radar operator, posted at several stations all around the coast of England from 1940 to 45, also referred to her own Protestant background as a consideration in her decision to enlist, stating that me and all my relations and friends in County Limerick joined up. All the men I knew in Ireland joined something, and the women minded the farms. It was the done thing to do, something and more in my circle. Elizabeth Dobbs from Dublin, and a Church of Ireland Protestant, joined the Fleet Air Arm in London in 1942 as a student, citing much the same reasons as Maureen Deaton. Dobbs stated that she joined the British forces because she just wanted to, and felt that the Navy was the best service and was keen to join the Wrens, but was initially thwarted by the embargo that had been put in place on recruiting Wrens from Southern Ireland. She initially served in the St. John Ambulance Brigade with a friend and worked as a nurse's aide in Surrey a year before joining up. Dobbs also explained that most Protestants felt something to do with England, and members of family were no exception. Her uncles had fought in the Great War, one being killed in action, and her brother would serve in the RAF during the Second World War. She also spoke of the encouragement of her parents, who went on and on and on about joining up. Dobbs, the daughter of a Reverend Canon, and whose family influenced her decision to join up, was accompanied by Brenda Graham, a Trinity College graduate whose father had been a Royal Army Medical Corps medical officer in Flanders during the First World War, winning the Military Cross, and had also met her mother while serving on the Western Front, the romanticism of which proved to be a strong influence on Brenda. Her father, Dr. Graham, re-established the St. John Ambulance Corps in Dublin when the Second World War broke out, and it was through this organisation that both Brenda and Elizabeth had received first aid training and a knowledge of basic nursing care. But the two girls had a desire for adventure and wanted to do something positive in the war, and they also found life in neutral Ireland to be quite boring and restrictive, and they wanted to get away, especially to a part of the world where they could experience the war. It was with Brenda and other companions that Dobbs began her service to the British war effort as a nursing aide in Botley Park Hospital in Surrey, prior to enlistment in the Royal Navy, a vital form of service that was provided by many Irish women who joined the British Armed Forces. In the case of Brenda and Elizabeth, as with many fellow Irish who had volunteered, we see instances where individuals join because the influence of their family background or community. Like Elizabeth Dobbs, they state that joining the British forces was encouraged, even expected, from people with this background. And many of these interviews state that an affiliation with Britain through family and community was a very strong reason for joining up. Now, to conclude, throughout the Second World War, Southern Irish Protestants and members of the Unionist and Loyalist faction in Southern Ireland, on the whole, demonstrated sentiments that ran in a pro-British vein, and were broadly supportive of the British war effort. At the same time, they also proved to be surprisingly hostile towards their Northern Irish Unionist counterparts, and very much defensive of neutral Ireland. Their support for Irish neutrality, and opposition to any and all criticisms of the neutral Irish state, was predicated upon their belief that neutral policy was the better and wiser course for Southern Ireland, and more beneficial for their community. Robert Fisk notes that even the most hardened Southern Irish Unionists, whose sons were serving in the British Army, quietly agreed that neutrality was the better course for the country to adopt. There was probably some recognition that their community was safer in a neutral state, and that they might not have to suffer the privations endured by numerous other countries that were at war. Perhaps they also recognised that were Southern Ireland pushed into war, civil war might ensue. And very recent memories of the precarious position of the Protestant community during the Irish Civil War prompted them to adopt this particular view. Most importantly, neutral Irish policy enabled them to serve the British war effort without fear of reprisal from any majority faction. They did so alongside many thousands of Irish comrades in arms, mainly Catholics, and it was the recognition of this rather blatant act of benevolent neutrality towards the Allies that perhaps prompted them to defend the honour of neutral Ireland. Thank you.